to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 29th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Preschool expanding at Vinton-Shelsburg. $1.5 million grant helps district to add 3-year-old program at second site. And this is by Grace King out of Vinton. The Vinton-Shelsburg Community School District will begin offering 3-year-old preschool this fall in a second location, and it also is partnering with a child care center to offer on-campus before and after school care and preschooler care at those schools. This fall will be the first time preschool for 3-year-olds will be offered at Tilford Elementary School in Vinton. It's a game changer for the community and for families who may struggle with transportation or child care for kids, especially those in half-day preschool programs, said Kyle Copen, superintendent of the Vinton-Shelsburg Community School District. To accommodate more students at Tilford Elementary, the district is spending $3 million on new construction, funded in part by a $1.5 million grant from Future Ready Iowa. The grant was submitted by the school district in partnership with Virginia Gay Hospital and clinics in Vinton. The other $1.5 million is coming from the school's physical plant and equipment levy, a capital projects account funded by property taxes. When the school and the community join together, we create opportunities that make our community a more attractive place to live, and we strengthen the learning opportunities provided to children and students, Copen said. The district has been offering 4-year-old preschool at both elementary schools through its tiny Vikes Early Childhood Program, but 3-year-old preschool was offered only at Shelsburg Elementary. No fees are charged to attend the half-day 4-year-old preschool through the Iowa Statewide Voluntary Preschool Program. A fee is charged for the 3-year-old preschool unless a child qualifies for early access intervention services offered to children with developmental concerns. About 90 students are enrolled in the half-day 4-year-old preschool, which is open 4 days a week from 8 to 11 a.m. or noon to 3 p.m. About 30 students are enrolled in the 3-year-old preschool in Shelsburg, offered 2 days a week from 8 to 11 a.m. Last summer, two educators, Meredith Zuspan, a reading teacher at Shelsburg Elementary, and Kelsey Fish, a coach with Grantwood Area Education Agency, bought Creative Kids, which opened in 2015. They directed the center this school year while keeping their jobs, but will transition this summer to operating the child care program full-time and expanding it to include preschoolers. This fall, Creative Kids, open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., will expand to Tilford Elementary and provide before and after school child care to preschool students as well. Creative Kids also offers summer child care for a fee. Zuspan said it was an emotional decision to leave teaching after 15 years, but she enjoys interacting with children at Creative Kids in a different way. We're both working moms, and we were when our kids were in preschool. We know the barrier transportation and childcare is for families. This is really important to us, Zuspan said. Purchasing the center, with the help of about $30,000 in grant funding, was a no-brainer, Fish said. It's not often someone can leave education and teaching and still get to impact kids and make a difference in their lives, Fish said. When Creative Kids went on the market, we ultimately were a little scared knowing how important childcare is in these small rural communities, Fish said. We did not want to see this go. It has a great reputation and we hated to see something happen to that. Who better to own and operate a childcare center than two people who already have connections in the community to the families and the kids? For more information about Creative Kids, visit creativekidsvs.com. Our next story, requests to delay pipeline decision denied. Opponents seized on Summit's plans to add more ethanol plants. By Jared Strong. In a split vote, the Iowa Utilities Board declined to solicit more evidence before it decides whether to issue a pipeline permit to Summit Carbon Solutions, according to a board order issued last week. In recent months, the company has more than doubled the number of ethanol producers to which its system would connect and added 340 miles of pipe, a roughly 50% increase. It indicated in March it would file 14 new permit requests for that expansion, with the IUB while its initial permit application still was pending. The Iowa Utilities Board is poised to make a decision for the first permit, and pipeline opponents seized on the expansion to make an 11th-hour bid to delay the decision. The Sierra Club of Iowa argued that the evidentiary record should be reopened and the permit applications consolidated, which would potentially elongate the process for many months. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation did not ask for a consolidation, but sought to reopen the record to determine how the expansion will affect the initial proposal. Iowa Utilities Board member Joshua Burns agreed with the Farm Bureau. The board should demand that the route for a project of this size and magnitude be the product of comprehensive planning to ensure the final route is the most efficient to accomplish the project's objectives and to minimize the impact on Iowa landowners. Some have suggested that the initial route and expansion plans could be revamped to reduce the total miles of pipeline. Sweeping changes could significantly delay the project's approval. Because the company voluntarily chose to open the door to the expanded ethanol plant partners, I believe it is fair to at least ask about the potential impact the additional trunk and lateral pipelines may have on the proposed pipeline, Burns wrote in his dissent Thursday. Some had objected to the request in part because of the potential delays to its initial permit process that has been ongoing for more than 2 years. The company said its requests for separate permits for the extensions fit with board procedure despite the fact the board has yet to rule on the initial permit, and that it could seek to amend the conditions of the initial permit if needed to accommodate the extensions. The two other IUB members, Eric Helland and Sarah Martz, overruled Burns and agreed with Summit about reopening the record. Their decision about the initial permit request will be based upon the evidence already presented, Helland and Martz wrote. All three board members denied the request to consolidate the permit applications. Summit's initial proposal includes about 690 miles of pipe that would connect to a dozen ethanol plants and transport their captured carbon dioxide to North Dakota for underground storage. The project has been delayed by setbacks in the Dakotas, where Summit's first proposals were rejected by state regulators. Okay, I'm going to turn to the Iowa Today section under the government notes. Higley Mansion rezoning advances. Former Cedar Rapids Senior Facility could become residential rehab site. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week advanced a request to rezone Higley Mansion, which used to operate as a senior living facility, to allow it to be turned into a residential rehab house offering voluntary treatment to those struggling with substance abuse issues. The property at 860 17th Street Southeast, which has been vacant for a couple of years, would be used as a residential inpatient and outpatient substance abuse treatment facility with 35 to 45 beds. It would be operated by Covenant Family Solutions with affiliated mental health services. The property will be rezoned from traditional residential flex district to traditional residential high district. It still needs conditional use approval from the Board of Adjustment, which will be considered at the Board's 4 p.m. May 16th meeting. The Council also has to twice more approve the rezoning, probably at its noon May 14th meeting. Both meetings are in the Council chambers at City Hall, 101 First Street Southeast. I'm just so happy to see this and to see what at least seems like the community's support for this, Councilmember Ashley Vanorney said. To have a resource like this at home means that more Cedar Rapidians are going to get the help they need and be successful because it's right here at home. If approved, the facility is slated to open in the spring or summer of 2025. This is an important service for our community, and I think that there's partners that have put this together that will strengthen our services that we have available in the community, but also, at the same time, bring what was a very unique complex back to life, Councilmember Scott Olson said. Marion Farmers Market opens May 4th. The Marion Farmers Market reopens for the season Saturday at Taube Park, 2231st Street in Marion. It will be open every Saturday from 8 to 11 a.m. through September 28th. The first market will have more than 30 vendors, including ones enrolled in the Farmers Market Nutrition Program and the Linn County Master Gardeners. Shoppers will find fresh produce, baked goods, meats, flowers, honey, jewelry, woodworking and crafts at the market, along with chocolate and wine vendors added this year. Marion City Council members will hold their weekly office hours at the market. Every Saturday, one or more council member will be available to answer questions and make conversation during market hours. The first Cedar Rapids Downtown Farmers Market will be Saturday, May 25th from 7:30 a.m. to noon. Knoll Ridge Greenhouse opens Mother's Day. Open Mother's Day. The annual Mother's Day showcase will be held at the Knoll Ridge Greenhouse, 4900 Council Street Northeast, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. May 12th. Admission is free. This year, 60,000 plants await visitors. There also will be an exhibit and information on orchids, master gardeners, and the Harshbarger Hosta Society. Visitors may purchase hanging baskets, coleus plants, New Guinea impatiens, native plants, perennials, houseplants, and orchids. Bird feeders, garden labels, gourds, and handcrafted pressed flower cards also will be for sale. Those interested in volunteering at the greenhouse can talk to members from the Friends of Knoll Ridge. The group will also sell fairy gardens, cactus cocktails, and succulent sundaes to raise funds to benefit the greenhouse. Cedar Rapids again recognized as a Tree City USA. The city of Cedar Rapids was honored as a 2023 Tree City USA at the 33rd Annual Community Forestry Awards Luncheon in Ankeny. It's the city's 46th consecutive award, a longer stretch than any other city in Iowa. The Arbor Day Foundation and the Iowa Department of Natural Resources presented the award April 4th at the FFA Enrichment Center in Ankeny. The award recognizes the city's commitment to a vibrant community tree canopy. To qualify, communities must have either a city tree department or an active city tree board, a tree ordinance, spend at least $2 per capita each year on its community forestry program, and have a tree planting and maintenance plan. Open house set at Iowa City Wastewater Plant. Iowa City's annual Public Works open house will take place at the city's wastewater treatment facility, 4366 Napoleon Street Southeast, from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, May 18th. The event will include tours of the facility, refreshments, educational opportunities, and games. Iowa City's wastewater staff manage the 330 miles of sanitary sewer piping that processes about 7.17 million gallons of wastewater every day. The open house will provide a glimpse into how this often ignored service is done without interruption throughout the year. Those wishing to attend should enter the facility off Sand Road Southeast and Napoleon Street and follow signs directing visitors down Soccer Park Road. The facility is adjacent to Kickers Soccer Park, which will be hosting soccer matches during the event, but there will be ample parking at the facility. Iowa City seeks sculptures for public display. Iowa City's Public Art Advisory Committee is offering Iowa sculptors a chance to showcase their work in the city for 2 years. The temporary exhibits, in place from August 7th this year through July of 2026, will be placed on pads at the Terry Trueblood Recreation Area along the Iowa River Trail in Riverfront Crossings Park, at Mercer Park, and at Scott Park. The Arts Advisory Committee will review and select submissions and determine the location for each. Proposed sculptures will be evaluated on artistic merit, creativity, public safety, appropriateness to their location, and durability in the outdoors and before an unsupervised general audience. Works must be able to be securely installed on a 4x4-foot cement pad. Unstable, fragile, dangerous, inappropriate, or small, lightweight works will not be accepted. Artists will receive an honorarium of $2,250 for the 2-year display. The deadline for submissions is May 17th. Detailed information and the online submission form are at www.icgov.org/publiccart. Questions can be directed to Rachel Kilberg Varley at 319-356-5248. Cedar Rapids Schools receive Career Ed Grant. The Cedar Rapids Community School District is one of 20 Iowa school districts to receive a Credentials to Career grant from the Iowa Department of Education. The grant was developed to help school districts create or enhance their career and technical education programs so that high school students can earn industry-recognized credentials or certifications before graduating. The grant aligns with the Cedar Rapids School District's new strategic plan of preparing students for life after graduation. The district will receive $281,776 through the grant for the 2024-25 school year. The funds will be used to buy equipment for high school industrial technology programs. The equipment will allow students to earn industry certifications, which increase their employability in precision measurement instruments, hand tool identification, and safety and electricity introduction. Arthur Garfield Open Houses Saturday. The public is invited to open houses at Arthur and Garfield Elementary Schools on Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon to commemorate each of the building's last years as schools in the Cedar Rapids School District. The student bodies at each school will merge and relocate to the new Trailside Elementary School, 2630 B Avenue Northeast, slated to open its doors in August. Arthur Elementary, 2630 B Avenue Northeast, and Garfield Elementary, 1201 Maplewood Drive Northeast, will be repurposed with community input. The closure of the schools and opening of Trailside Elementary is part of a 2018 facilities master plan. Under the plan, the school district also built and opened West Willow Elementary School in August 2021, which replaced Coolidge Elementary. Maple Grove Elementary opened in August 2022 to replace Jackson Elementary. Each new elementary school serves between 500 and 600 students. Right now, elementary schools vary in student population, ranging from 200 to 500 students. Improvements to the elementary schools are funded by Secure and Advanced Vision for Education, a statewide school infrastructure sales and services tax. Our next story, report Quad Cities to get warmer and wetter. Assessment looks at how climate change will affect region. This is out of the Quad City Times by Sarah Watson. More intense flooding, drought, and hotter temperatures are expected in the Quad Cities in the coming decades as a result of climate change, according to a new report. The assessment, Navigating Climate Challenges in the Quad Cities, was done by the National Wildlife Federation, Prairie Rivers Network, and the Discovery Partners Institute at the University of Illinois System in an effort to analyze the potential impacts of climate change on the Quad Cities through the end of the century and offer general solutions. Climate change is a long-term change in the average weather patterns locally, regionally, and globally. Changes in Earth's climate since the mid-20th century are driven by human activities, according to NASA, particularly fossil fuel burning, which increases heat-trapping greenhouse gas levels in Earth's atmosphere, raising Earth's average surface temperature. Average temperatures have risen about a degree in Iowa since the beginning of the 20th century, concentrated in the fall and winter. We found that the Quad Cities will begin to experience more frequent and more destructive floods shortly, said Arsam Pathak, Senior Adaptation Specialist for the National Wildlife Federation. Our research also shows that solutions such as permeable pavement, green roofs, and stormwater gardens can significantly reduce flooding. Seven of the top 10 historic crests of the Mississippi River at the Rock Island Gauge have occurred in the 21st century, according to the National Weather Service. Flood simulations done by the scientists in the report show areas close to the Mississippi River becoming more prone to river floods because of increased rainfall and higher stream flows. The report stated places such as Cargill Ag Horizons, Isle Casino, Hotel Bettendorf, the Martin Luther King Center, Vibrant Arena at the Mark, and Lindsay Park Yacht Club could become susceptible to flooding as early as 2040. Water from heavy rain events could affect areas like the I-74 Bridge and downstream Rock Island by 2080 or 2090. The Quad Cities also can expect more days reaching above 95 degrees. Under a high emission scenario, the Quad Cities could experience nearly 2 months of temperatures soaring above 95 degrees, according to the report. The area currently experiences an average of 3 days over 95 degrees a year. Our analysis suggests the Mississippi region will experience warmer and wetter conditions in the future, along with an increase in extreme precipitation events, said Ashish Sharma, the climate and urban sustainability lead at the Discovery Partners Institute. The risks of climate change in the Quad Cities will more greatly affect people living and working in floodplains in Moline, East Moline, and downtown Davenport along the Mississippi and Rock Rivers, the report said, and will disproportionately affect vulnerable populations such as lower-income families, people experiencing homelessness, and people with disabilities. The report recommends nature-based solutions to combat the impacts of climate change on the region. Those include restoring wetlands, floodplains and forests, and green spaces that would reduce the risks of flooding and flash flooding, according to the report. Nahant Marsh, for example, in western Davenport, acts as a massive urban floodwater sponge, according to the report. It catches and filters up to 2 billion gallons of water during peak flows of the Mississippi River. Patak said wetlands, such as Nahant Marsh, will face challenges with disruptions in water balance because of more frequent droughts and flash flooding, and that effects of climate change would be more severe without resources like Nahant. The report also recommends increasing tree cover to shrink heat islands and provide more shade during periods of extreme heat. As part of the review, researchers interviewed 30 regional natural resource professionals, conservation staff from the cities of Davenport, Moline, Rock Island, and East Moline, and nonprofit and community leaders. Researchers emphasized the findings of the assessment are not static, and there's uncertainty about future changes to emission trajectories, population changes, and the limitations of climate modeling. The findings seem like a lot and a little scary, but this is by no means a way, but this is by no way meant to be a doom and gloom report, Pathak said. The risks are not static, they are still based on projections, emission scenarios. The actions and policies we can act on today can change the future greenhouse gas emissions and the flooding scenarios. In our next story, DNR, Farmer Left Behind Fertilizer Spill, by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A man whose large fertilizer tank ruptured while he was driving in Burlington this past week did not report the spill, drove away from it, and initially refused to help clean a creek it contaminated, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Jeff Boyer, 65, of rural Oakville, was driving a truck and trailer near Burlington Notre Dame High School about 4:45 p.m. last Monday when a tank he was hauling shifted, broke open, and released up to 700 gallons of ammonia phosphate, the DNR said. Boyer stopped briefly after noticing the spill and then left, according to the DNR. He could not be reached to comment for this article. The spill covered a stretch of roadway of more than 1,000 feet, and an unknown amount of the fertilizer went into a stormwater sewer that flows to Hawkeye Creek, said Robert Burnt, fire marshal for the Burlington Fire Department. The department was the first to respond to the incident, which was reported by another driver who had been following Boyer when it happened. Firefighters used about 3,000 pounds of absorbent material to clean the spill and to stop more of the fertilizer from going into the creek. The creek contamination did not cause an apparent fish kill, said Anthony Kirker, an environmental specialist for the DNR, but it discolored the creek up to about a mile away from the spill site. Boyer pretty much refused to remedy the problem as required by state rules, which might have included pumping contaminated water out of the creek bed, Kirker said. The city eventually decided to flush the creek Wednesday with about 200,000 gallons of water from a hydrant to dilute the contamination, Kirker said. The creek flows into the Mississippi River. City staff have been monitoring it closely, Kirker said. Still no signs of dead fish or other aquatic life. The city plans to bill Boyer for cleanup, and he will likely face a separate penalty from the DNR, Kirker said. The Burlington Police Department also anticipates it will cite Boyer for at least one traffic violation, said Sergeant Chad Zahn, a spokesperson for the department. He declined to speculate what that might be. Boyer owns a cropland east of Oakville, about 20 miles north of Burlington, according to county records. He also operates a livestock confinement with about 1,600 swine, DNR records show. And now we're going to turn to the insight opinion section and to our community letters. We have two today. Our first one from Alice Dahl of Cedar Rapids. Iowa, Linn County, must help sexual assault survivors. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. After enduring the trauma of sexual assault, survivors need emotional support and medical treatment to process what has happened and begin to take steps toward healing and regaining control of their lives. For years, money to pay for medical exams, testing for sexually transmitted infections, and treatment, including the cost of emergency contraception, came from Iowa's Victim Compensation Fund, paid for by fines and penalties assessed from convicted criminals. When Attorney General Brenna Byrd took office, those funds were suddenly no longer available. Her office issued statements that Byrd was conducting an, quotes, audit of victim services to determine whether payment for treatment following a sexual assault is an appropriate use of public funds. More than a year later, there is no conclusion to the audit, and funding has not resumed. Both Polk and Johnson counties have adopted policies that provide funding for necessary medical care, including emergency contraception for sexual assault victims, but Linn County has not. I have been disappointed that after several attempts to reach my representative in the Linn County Supervisor's Office, I have had no response other than one brief phone conversation. After suffering a sexual assault, survivors should not have to worry about whether to seek treatment and how to pay for it. Linn County residents should insist that it be public policy to stand with survivors and provide all the assistance they need. And again, that was from Alice Dahl of Cedar Rapids. And our next letter is from Kay Brown of Coralville. Republican tax cuts are why we can't have nice things. I like nice things, a glass of pure, clean water, a smooth, clear road ahead, a pristine state park, watching kids splash in a river or lake. Just how far those things are out of reach became apparent to me when my son and I picked up our 2023 Iowa income tax returns. My son's income, primarily from a full-time job, is about one-fourth of mine, but his tax bill is more than $400 larger than mine. This year, for the first time, retirement income is untaxed. Meanwhile, we are told there is no money for some of my nice things. My son and his fellow wage earners will be providing the nice things, if we get any, from incomes that barely sustain a reasonable standard of living. Retirees whose incomes are in the range of my son's deserve an exemption from tax. Some of us do not. What to do with my $5,000 reduction in taxes? I would send a check for the amount owed last year, but I fear those funds would end up in the state, in quotations, surplus, to justify further tax cuts or the move to a flat tax, which is even more regressive. My question for my neighbors and fellow Iowans, is this the kind of state we want, or can we agree on a vision that we are able and willing to support together? And that again was from Kay Brown of Coralville. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and if you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Karen K. Kuhn Wennekamp, 76, of Marion, passed away on Friday, April 26th at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf's Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Friends may call from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, May 1st at Ascension Lutheran Church, located at 2210 Grand Avenue in Marion. Daniel Lutke will officiate. Burial will follow at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. Karen was born on September 24, 1947, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Carl and Verba Parker Kuhn. She was a 1965 graduate of Jefferson High School and went on to attend the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. On July 7, 1973, Karen was united in marriage to Robert, Bob, John Wennekamp, and they made a life together for over 50 years. To this union, three children were born: Jennifer, or Jenny, Catherine, Katie, and John. Karen was an avid reader who enjoyed doing calligraphy, making handmade greeting cards, scrapbooking, listening to music, and playing the piano. Most of all, Karen loved spending time with her family and going to all her grandchildren's activities. She will be greatly missed by all who knew and loved her. Karen is survived and lovingly remembered by her husband, Bob Wennekamp of Marion, children Jenny, spouse Joe Ringwald of Cedar Rapids, Katie, spouse Karen McCants of Cordova, Illinois, and John, spouse Abby Wennekamp of Marion. Four grandchildren, Jackson and Joy Ringwald, and Elena and Henry Wennekamp, along with two step-grandsons, Josh and Jason Buzzard, and her beloved dog, Ollie. She was preceded in death by her parents. Memorials to Karen's memory may be directed to the family to be designated later. James Dion McKittrick, 63, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Moline, Illinois, passed away on April 28th at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Celebration of life will be held at a later date. Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. James was born on April 16th, 1961, in Davenport, the son of Robert and Peggy Weir McKittrick. James loved the outdoors, especially camping with his family. He also was an avid moped rider and loved to listen to Led Zeppelin. James is survived by his children, Sean McKittrick and Brittany, spouse Ryan Armstrong, stepchildren, Anthony, spouse Angel Thurn, Anita Escobedo, Tammy Escobedo, and Jerry, spouse Sonia Jealous, 11 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. James was preceded in death by his parents and brother Robert McKittrick, Jr. Patricia Patty Marie Smith, 75, of Anamosa, died Saturday, April 27th. Funeral Mass will take place at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Patty was born January 11, 1949, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Frank and Mary Philip McCallick. She graduated from LaSalle High School. Patty dedicated herself to raising her children and later worked for Country Kitchen in Marion, Happy Chef in Cedar Rapids, and City Limits Lounge and Restaurant in Anamosa. She was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Anamosa. Survivors include her children, Rodney, spouse Deb Smith, Don McNelly, Wendy Smith, all of Anamosa, Rick Smith of Cedar Rapids, and Matthew, spouse Sam Smith of Mason City. 17 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, siblings Philly McCallick, Billy, spouse Sherry McCallick, Michael, spouse Diane McCallick, Robert McCallick, Rosie Harvey, Teresa, spouse Bob Ruzica, and sister Mary Frances, all of Cedar Rapids, and sister-in-law Karen McCallick. She was preceded in death by her parents Frank and Mary McCallick, fiancé Tony Imhoff, daughter Lori Mead, and siblings Joan Marie Miller, Franklin, Benjamin, and Bernard McCallick. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family for a memorial fund that will be established in Patty's honor. Joseph James Vapp, 77, of Manchester, passed away on Saturday, April 22nd, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. He was born on September 6, 1946, in Campbell, Nebraska, the middle son of Ray and Grace Vance Vapp. Joe was raised in Nebraska and graduated from Holstein, Nebraska High School in 1964. He then attended Kearney State and Creighton University, receiving a degree in dentistry. Joe did his internship in St. Louis, Missouri, before becoming a doctor of dentistry. On July 24, 1971, Joe was united in marriage to Pam Gidley in Creston. Two children were born to this union. Joe and Pam moved to Manchester in 1973 and opened his dentistry practice. He retired from his practice in 2011. Joe was a member of the Manchester Methodist Church, Methodist Choir, various dental associations, West Delaware Booster Club, Manchester Lions, and was a Boy Scout leader. He enjoyed being part of the barbershop quartet, the Jones Mills Music Company. Joe enjoyed golfing, hunting, fishing, annual trips to Canada, and the great outdoors. He also enjoyed traveling to their property in Montana. Joe loved taking his family on trips to other countries. Most of all, Joe enjoyed spending time with family and entertaining his friends. Survivors include his wife of 52 years, Pam Vapp, of Manchester, his son Mitchell, spouse Angela Vapp, their sons Logan and Levi of Missoula, Montana, his daughter Nicole, spouse Jeremy Freeman of Sedalia, Missouri, his brother Ron, spouse Rhonda Vapp of Blue Hill, Nebraska, his sisters-in-law Janice Vapp of Sanibel, Florida, and Jackie Schaefer of Creston, brother-in-law Jim, spouse Linda Gidley of Omaha, Nebraska, and nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, his brother Don Vapp, his stepfather Bud Harlow, his parents-in-law Wayne and Elaine Gidley, and brother-in-law Richard Schaefer. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonardmullerfuneralhome.com. Memorial service will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 7th, at Manchester Methodist Church in Manchester, with Reverend Phil Rogers officiating. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Monday, May 6th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may also call from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Tuesday at the church. Interment will be at the Oakland Cemetery in Manchester. John Joseph Kroc, 65, of Manchester, passed away on Wednesday, April 24th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the American Cancer Society. Online condolences may be sent to www.leonard-mullerfh.com. Massive Christian burial will be from 11 a.m. on Tuesday, April 30th, 2024, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation is from 3 to 7 p.m. on Monday, April 29th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Interment will be at St. Mary Catholic Cemetery in Manchester. Give me 1 second. There we go. Dean Leo Reck, 75, of Marion, died Friday, April 26th, in Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital, surrounded by his family. A celebration of life will be held on Wednesday, May 1st, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Hunter's Ridge Golf Course Clubhouse, 2901 Hunter's Ridge Road in Marion. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Survivors include his wife of 54 years, Diane Reck, his children, Timothy, spouse Melissa Reck of Marion, Jen, spouse Marcus Boog of Little Canada, Minnesota, his grandchildren, Sullivan, Zoe, Bella, and Maxwell, sister-in-law, Nancy Stifel of Independence, brother-in-law, Kermit Casey of Marion, brothers Dale, spouse Cindy Reck of Anamosa, and David, spouse Betsy Reck of Madison, Wisconsin, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Howard and Juanita Reck, in-laws Lowell and Ruth Manros, Uncle Bud and Aunt Dory, and a nephew, Kyle Meyer. Dean was born in Manchester. He grew up in Independence and graduated from Jefferson High School. He met the love of his life, Diane Manros, at age 17. He attended Iowa State University and graduated from Hawkeye Technology in Waterloo. He later married Diane on July 12, 1969, in Independence, and they relocated to Freeport, Illinois. In 1971, their son Timothy was born, followed by their daughter Jen in 1974. Dean's career spanned 42 years, where he worked in sales, purchasing, and engineering before retiring in 2011. After retiring, Dean and Diane were able to spend many winters in Florida. They were also able to visit Alaska and Europe. One of their favorite trips was being able to take their grandchildren and children to Florida, including Disney World. Dean valued family above all else and especially enjoyed spending time with his children and grandchildren. He loved to spend time golfing, fishing, and camping. He was a great bowler and enjoyed boating and spending time on the water. He enjoyed watching sports, especially the Iowa Hawkeyes. He was fiercely competitive in any game or contest, whether it be on the high school football field or a friendly game of Uno with the grandkids. Dean courageously battled multiple forms of cancer over the last 7 years. His kindness, generosity of spirit, and contagious laugh will be greatly missed. In lieu of flowers, the family would like you to donate to the mental health charity To Write Love on Her Arms, TWLOHA.com. Phyllis Elaine Swales, 98, of Iowa City, passed away on April 26th. She was born on January 13th, 1926, in Lake Mills, to the late Theodore and Frances Rusley. Phyllis, known to all as Elaine, dedicated the early years of her career as a bookkeeper at Swales Refrigeration. In subsequent years, she was actively involved in various civic organizations, including the Girl Scouts of America, Iowa City Pilot Club, and the Iowa City Camel Wheels Shrine Club. Elaine was an avid Iowa Hawkeye fan who enthusiastically followed the football as well as men's and women's basketball teams. Elaine was a proud alumna of Iowa City City High and the University of Iowa. She will be deeply missed by her loving family, including her son Mark, spouse Mindy Swales, her daughter Fran, spouse Jimmy Bridges, daughter-in-law Sarah, spouse Steve Swales, 6 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. Elaine was preceded in death by her husband of 50 years, Larry, and her son, Stephen. Elaine worshipped at the United Methodist Church, finding solace and community in her faith. Funeral services will be held 2 p.m. Wednesday, May 1st, at Gay and Siha Funeral and Cremation Service, with burial to follow at Memory Gardens Cemetery in Iowa City. There will be a time of visitation 1 hour prior to the services at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in her honor to the Lustgarten Foundation for Research and a Cure of Pancreatic Cancer. Mary Jo Weber, 80, of Hazleton, passed away Friday afternoon, April 26, at her home. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 2nd, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine. Prayer service will be at 7 p.m. Thursday at the funeral home, with Deacon Jim Petura officiating. Interment at a later date in Woodlawn Cemetery. Mary Josephine Stocks was born in Geneseo, Illinois, on July 22, 1943, as the only child of Donald Allen and Winifred Winnie Hannon Stocks. She later attended nursing school at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Mary Jo also spent many years as a school nurse with the Independent School District. While working as a nurse in Chicago, she met and married Dr. John Weber. They were married on June 18, 1966, and enjoyed over 57 years of marriage. Mary Jo and John raised 3 children: Megan, spouse Louis Brow of Park Ridge, Illinois; Chris, spouse Catherine Weber of Chicago, Illinois; and Matt Weber of Rosemount, Minnesota. She truly enjoyed spending time with her 7 grandkids, Maggie and Sarah Brow, Mary Claire, Colin and Joe Weber, and Michaela and Allie Weber. She was preceded in death by her parents. She will be missed by all. Donald Gene, Eugene Vandeveer, 89, of Belle Plaine, passed away April 14th at his home. Gene was born on November 11th, 1934, to Willis and Mary Gordon Vandeveer in Belle Plaine. He attended Belle Plaine High School. Enlisting into the U.S. Navy at a young age, Gene spent over 20 years proudly serving his country before retiring in 1972. Gene married Bonnie Hilton on July 31st, 1956, and was blessed with 3 children. Upon their separation, Gene married Glenna Vandeveer in 1981. By this marriage, Gene was blessed to adopt 2 more children. Gene enjoyed fishing many local ponds and rivers, bowling, and was an accomplished pool player, traveling to Vegas for yearly tournaments. He was a member of the Belle Plaine American Legion, the Masons and Shriners organizations. He was known for his lighthearted orneriness, a jokester that loved to play pranks on family and friends, keeping them guessing at what he would come up with next. Gene is survived by his first wife, Bonnie, wife Glenna, son Calvin Vandeveer of Florida, daughters Teresa Vandeveer of Alabama, and Vicky Teeter of Florida, adopted children Teresa, Christine, and Rodney Vandeveer of New Mexico, siblings Margaret Clark of Belle Plaine, Carol Novotny of Cedar Rapids, Kay Hartgrave of Newall, Ernie Vandeveer of Arkansas, and Jim Vandeveer of Cedar Rapids, along with several nieces, nephews, family, and friends. He is preceded in death by his parents, brothers Eddie, Venice, and Gordon, who is known as Dale, Celebration of Life is 11 a.m. Saturday, May 4th at the Belle Plaine American Legion with military honors. Memorials may be directed to Essence of Life Hospice or Belle Plaine Legion in Jean's honor. Reverend Mildred Board Grubbs, 105, of Tupelo, Mississippi, formerly of Cascade, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, November 11th, 2023. Graveside service will be at 9:30 a.m. May 3rd, 2024, Cascade Cemetery in Cascade. Memorial service will be at 11 a.m. on May 3rd, First Presbyterian Church, Mount Vernon, with time for food and fellowship to follow. She received her B.A. degree from the University of Dubuque, her M.A. degree in Christian Education from McCormick Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Chicago, Illinois, and her Master of Divinity degree from Christian Theological Seminary, Indianapolis, Indiana. She was ordained to the Ministry of Word and Sacrament in 1964, one of the first women to become a minister of the United Presbyterian Church. Before her ordination, she served churches in Mississippi, Arizona, and Indiana as Director of Christian Education. She held an executive position with the Board of Christian Education of the United Presbyterian Church, with an office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from which she traveled 11 states developing and training lay leadership of local churches. She was again called to executive leadership and was the first woman to hold a position in the denomination's personnel service. She was also the associate executive presbyter of the Presbytery of Western New York with offices in Buffalo. As the first installed woman pastor in East Iowa Presbytery, she was pastor of the Presbyterian Church of Blairstown for 10 years. During these years, she was elected moderator of the presbytery and chaired several of its major committees. After her retirement, she led several churches of the presbytery as interim pastor. She is survived by a second cousin, Darlene Mathis, spouse Charles, nephews Dr. Ray Grubbs, Harold Grubbs, spouse Lynn of Brinkley, Arkansas, David Grubbs, spouse Laura of Ashland, Dennis Grubbs, spouse Emily of Shannon, Mike Grubbs, spouse Kathy, and Mark Grubbs, spouse Elizabeth, nieces June Briggs, spouse Ken, Molly Cash of Georgia, and Kay Whitehead. Preceding her in death were her husband William L. Grubbs, parents Mr. and Mrs. Leroy Board, sister Mrs. Robert E. Hill Jr., and niece Pamela Hill Griffith. Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section. And first of all, events of area interest today. In high school track, we have Kennedy at Marion Invitational at 4:30 p.m. In girls golf, Kennedy, Washington, Linmar, Xavier, Prairie, Jefferson, Iowa City West, Liberty, City High, are in the Mississippi Valley Conference Super Meet at Ellis Golf Course. At 9:30 a.m., Marion is hosting WAMAC Divisional Meet at Gardner Golf Course. And at noon, Wilton will be at Regina at the Pleasant Valley Golf Course at 4:15 p.m. In boys golf, we have Marion at WAMAC Divisional Meet at West Delaware, Pin Oaks Golf Course, at noon. Region at Wilton at the Wauconsa Golf Course at 4 p.m. In boys tennis, Marion, Independence, and South Tama will be at Grinnell at 9 a.m. Girls soccer, Regina at Mid Prairie at 5 p.m., boys soccer, Mid Prairie at Regina at 5 p.m. In men's golf, Coe, Luther at American Rivers Conference Tournament in Des Moines at Glen Oaks. And in college softball, Minnesota is at Iowa at 11 a.m. On television, you can see the NBA playoffs, Celtics at the Heat at 6:30 p.m. on TNT and True TV. Thunder is at the Pelicans at 7:30 p.m. on NBA TV. Lakers at the Nuggets at 9 p.m. on TNT and True TV. In the NHL playoffs, Lightning at Panthers at 6 p.m. on ESPN. Stars at Golden Knights at 8:30 p.m. also on ESPN. In Major League Baseball, the Cubs are at the Mets at 6 p.m. this evening on the Marquee Channel. Twins at White Sox at 6:30 p.m. on FS1 and NBCS Chicago. In golf, the 2024 PGA Professional Championship is at 4 p.m. on the Golf Channel. And on the radio, you can catch the Cubs at the Mets at 6 p.m. on KXIC 800. And in the headline, it's the Drake Relays. The weekend's best came after rain delay. Weather went from dismal to advantageous, and the high school athletes that stuck around made the most of it. This is by Jeff Linder out of Des Moines. Prom dates were broken, records were broken. Such was life in a spectacular hour-long display to close the Drake Relays late Saturday. A storm-induced delay of nearly 3 hours sent the majority of the crowd and a few competitors home. For most of those who stayed, it was worth it. "I had prom tonight, and I'm going to miss that," Cedar Rapids Prairie's Jackson Johannes said, "but a school record in the boys' 1600-meter relay makes up for it." Western Dubuque's Ava Goins was more direct. "My date is a little bum," she said. "He can get over it." Drake officials suspended competition at 4:14 p.m. with six high school events remaining. At about 6:45, the all-clear was announced with competition resuming at 7:05. It was like, should we stay? Should we go? Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Jacob Doyle said, "We were sitting in the van when they announced that we could start warming up. We got loose fast." Western Dubuque's girls and Kennedy's boys were seated 6th and 8th, respectively, in the 400-meter relay. Both finished 2nd. "I'm so freaking proud of us," the Bobcats' Claire Stunts said, added anchor Bryn Walters. "After they said it was delayed, we just chilled and got our mindset right. When we came back out, we were so excited. They ran that way." Western Dubuque ran in 47.94 seconds, just behind Waukee Northwest at 47.89. In the next race, a Dell ADM set a Drake record in 41.38 seconds. Kennedy's 41.79-second effort set a school mark. "Our coach gave us a pep talk. He said we could break a school record," Kennedy's Dawson Doherty said. After the storm passed, conditions were ideal for distance runners. West Des Moines Valley's Addison Dornkamp broke the Drake record in the girls' 1500 in 4 hours, 26 minutes, 93 seconds. Then Tony Anania of Norwalk did likewise in the boys' 1600. She broke the Drake record. Addison Dornkamp broke the Drake record in the girls' 1500 in 4 minutes, 26 seconds, 26.93 seconds. Then Tony Anania of Norwalk did likewise in the boys' 1600, 4 minutes, 6.54 seconds. Western Dubuque's Quentin Nauman was 3rd in 4 minutes, 10.44 seconds. Nauman jetted from the middle of the pack with 500 meters to go to the lead with 300 remaining. "I tried," Nauman said. "It's all right. It's another school record. It was go, go, go. I had nothing to lose. It was good competition. It's pretty cool." Pleasant Valley's girls put a bow on a spectacular weekend. The Spartans won the Drake Cup with a 1,600-meter relay title in 3 minutes, 51.51 seconds. Then Cedar Falls won the boys' 1,600 relay title in 3 minutes, 16.74 seconds. The 400-meter champion Friday, Johannes, anchored Prairie to 3rd in the boys' race. "We have a freshman, Drew Bennis, who was insane," Johannes said after the Hawks broke the school mark in 3 minutes, 18.36 seconds. "Weston Koch is insane. Carson Novi is insane. So what does that make you, Jackson?" "I'm all right," he said. Ankeny was the boys' relays cup champion. And our other front page headline, first round player, second round price. Eagles made concerted effort to select Iowa star defensive back DeJean. This is by John Stepp. Out of Iowa City, officially, Cooper DeJean was a second round pick in the 2024 NFL draft. But as the Philadelphia Eagles see it, they drafted a second first round caliber player just as number 40 overall instead of number 22. "It's rare for us to be picking in the 20s and to get two first-round players," Eagles general manager Howie Roseman said of DeJean and his first-round selection, Quinion Mitchell. "Both those guys were first-round players for us, and we didn't have 32 first-round guys." Roseman said the Eagles viewed DeJean as one of the best defensive players in the draft, and the Iowa star was a consideration when the Eagles made the 22nd overall pick. They instead selected Mitchell, a cornerback from Toledo, who ran a 4.33-second 40-yard dash at the NFL Combine. "Obviously, we took a guy that we loved as well as yesterday," Roseman said of Mitchell. The Eagles were not supposed to pick again until late in the second round, after other teams with defensive back needs, such as the Packers, Cardinals, and Texans, had second-round picks. But then the Eagles, as Roseman described it, made a concerted effort to get DeJean. They gave up the number 50, 53, and 161 picks to a division foe for the DeJean pick, and the number 78 and 152 picks. Probably didn't win on any of those charts that are going on in the internet for sure, Roseman told reporters in Philadelphia. The Jimmy Johnson trade value chart, one of the charts that is readily accessible online, values the picks the Eagles received at a score of 731 versus 797 for the picks given to the Washington Commanders. But DeJean's value to the Eagles exceeded what a standard chart or formula may show. I know just from talking to a bunch of my friends in the league after we made the trade, I think most of the league thought this guy would go yesterday, Roseman said, after Friday's second and third rounds. DeJean, while acknowledging a little frustration on Thursday night as teams passed on him, told reporters Friday night all he wanted was an opportunity to play. Now that opportunity is in Philadelphia, a place I wanted to be, he said. I'm excited to get started there and get out there and get rolling. Get back to playing football, DeJean said. I was getting tired of this pre-draft process, so I am excited to just get back to playing football. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.